when I voted for the things I voted for to date, it seemed a bit out of character for me as a person who wants less spending and less government, particularly from our nation's capital. But I think I and maybe many of us believe that this was a couple month thing in which if we could make a difference for that couple of months while COVID-19 worked its stuff, when that couple months was over, we would have kept people employed, we would have kept businesses open, we would have kept our schools prepared to return to school. Just the things that were important that we not lose. I'm of the view that the PPP program in particular was very helpful and necessary. And part of that belief on my part is influenced by being a rural Kansan, being a rural American, in which if we lose a business, the chances of us getting it back later just doesn't really exist. So for as long as I've been in representing you in Washington, D.C., I've explained to people over the years from time to time that where I come from, economic development can be whether or not there's a grocery store in town. And almost no one knows what I'm talking about in Washington. But if we lose our grocery store or a hardware store or something during this pandemic, the chances that it's going to be back on Main Street probably have disappeared. Certainly true for our hospitals. If we lose a hospital in a rural community in Kansas, or maybe any community in Kansas, and COVID then is over, but they couldn't survive what went on during COVID, which is basically no patients and therefore no revenue, or few patients and less revenue, then the chances of us getting our hospital back open after this is over. So we worked hard to try to provide some relief. PPP, I think, is known to people in Beloit, but it's the Paycheck Protection Program. Businesses less than 500 employees could borrow money to cover their employee costs, their wages and salaries, benefits, interest on debt, a few things like that. And if they kept their employees employed or rehired them, they'd get the loan forgiven. And 80% of the businesses in Kansas with less than 500 employees participated in that program. Our farmers, I was relegated. The Senate was out of session for 5 weeks during the COVID pandemic, so we were not meeting in Washington, D.C., and when I was home, my wife sent me to the basement where I've been living ever since, and I'm hoping that when COVID is over, I'm welcomed back to the main level of our house, but I'm waiting to see if COVID is just an excuse or she's become accustomed to this separate up-and-down lifestyle. We have a new grandson. I was telling somebody our first grandchild was born in January, and Rava became the daycare provider in the absence of daycare for those 5 weeks. And so my presence in the household was less than desirable for somebody who had been out and about and flying on an airplane. So again, but I also ended up discovering RFD TV while I was in the basement and saw market reports every 20 minutes for those 5 weeks. And we became very concerned about agriculture, another component like healthcare. That if we lose our farming community, the chances of them returning and restoring or keeping a young person on the farm disappears dramatically, and particularly the livestock sector, which is a significant component of Mitchell County and its economy, and the difficulty we had because of the lack of processing and meat packing capabilities. So there were things that really mattered to me and things that we have supported, but in the next phase, I think we need to be very targeted. We ought not just do a lot of spending on everything that people wish they could get money spent on. In my view, the priorities would be, I think we don't get well as an economy, as people, until we are well, until we have testing and vaccines and protection and masks. This is important. Someone was reminding me of this. I asked if this was controversial in Mitchell County or in Beloit. The answer was no, not really. It has become controversial. I don't understand it. I can understand a debate about whether government should tell us what to do. I don't understand a debate about what our personal responsibility should be to protect other people. I've had people tell me that, Jerry, I'm a Christian. I'm ready to go when God calls me, and I'm not wearing a mask. And I want to say, if I was less polite, I'd say, but what about love your neighbor part of Christianity? This is a lot less to do with about us protecting ourselves, and it's a lot about protecting our others. And so we need to do the things that get us healthy, and we know we're healthy, so we can feel comfortable with our kids going back to school, and we can feel comfortable going back to work. And so I'm interested in funding or helping fund the testing, the personal protection equipment, the vaccine, the distribution of the vaccine, things that help us set aside that we can, if we can get those things resolved, we can have a stronger economy, and we'll have less uncertainty about whether it's safe to go out and about. I would tell you that in regard to kind of the distancing and the masks, and there's a lot of people, if the president or the governor said, you're free to go out and do whatever you want to do, there's a lot of people who would love that moment. But sometimes I don't think it's recognized there's a whole other set of people who are very nervous about doing that because they have a grandchild at home, or they have a child with a disease, or they have something themselves. They're caring for their elderly parents. There's a lot of people who are very nervous, and we need to satisfy people that they and their family are healthy and it's safe to go out and about. So I'm all for trying to solve that aspect of COVID-19 in what we do next. And there's a few things I think that have slipped through the cracks that still deserve some of our attention. But my question or message to you is, I don't anticipate voting for something that is more trillions of dollars and more government spending. There's another side that we're never paying any attention to, and that's who's going to pick up the tab and what it does to us in the, not even the long term, but in the short and intermediate term, if we just keep adding trillions to our national debt. It's not a topic. When you first gave me the opportunity to represent you, people would talk to me regularly about government spending and the debt and deficit. It's a pretty rare thing these days. And unfortunately, I mean, I think in this country that Republicans and Democrats generally for a long time in our history thought that deficit spending was a bad thing. My view is that Democrats kind of, at least nationally, kind of wandered away from that concern. And then Republicans have followed suit. And you get lots of people that say, and in fact, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board has, Jerome Powell, and said, this is a time we ought to be borrowing all kinds of money at these low interest rates. But someday there will be a reckoning if we take that attitude. There's always a reason we know in our own lives, we can always justify spending money we don't have. But at some point in time, it has to be paid back. And so that's my take. I would add one topic and then turn this over to you all. Since I saw you last, in January, I became the chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. And one of the things that I'm not a veteran. I graduated from high school at a time that the Vietnam War had just come to an end. If you are a year or two older than me and you graduated from Plainville High School, you served in Vietnam. I'm just at that age in which I didn't. But I was at an age in which I saw how people were treated, our servicemen and women were treated when they returned. And unfortunately, I saw it even in Kansas. And I just remember as a 16-year-old kid saying, I'm going to try to make up for what I'm seeing happening to these young men and women and treat those who serve our country with respect and with honor. And then I became a member of Congress and decided that it's more than just respect and honor. I now have an opportunity or a responsibility to do more, to make sure that promises that we made to those who serve are kept. One of my learning experiences in representing you in this congressional district, called the First, is larger, as large as the state of Illinois. There is no VA hospital. And so how do we care for our veterans when it's so distant? For some reason, I always use Atwood, but you could pick any town in the neighborhood and say, if you're a veteran in Burr Oak, how do you get to the VA in Topeka or Wichita or Kansas City? Maybe there's something in Nebraska that you would tell me about, but how do you get there if you're disabled or elderly? And so we created outpatient clinics. In your case, the closest one is Salina. Those were new and created in my days in the House. But if you're a 94-year-old World War II veteran in Burr Oak, how do you get to Salina? And so we pushed for a long time trying to get care in the community. So we passed, 5 years ago, something called Choice, and we told veterans, it's your choice, veterans. If you live more than 40 miles from a VA facility, you can have care at home if that's what you want. See your hometown doc, be admitted to your hometown hospital. It's a good thing, but the VA didn't like it, and in my view, implemented it in ways that made it very difficult for veterans to actually get the care or the providers to get paid. So we've changed the law, trying to overcome the pushback from the VA, and we have a new Secretary of Veterans Affairs who I think embraces the idea of care in the community, but there's still thousands of people who work at the VA who may not want any patient to leave their facilities, want everything done in-house. And we passed something now called the Mission Act. My guess is it will always be called Choice. The president still calls it choice, but it's the Mission Act. And it says, instead of this criteria of whether you live 40 miles, let me tell you my 40-mile story. So Larry, a Vietnam veteran in my hometown, called me one day to say, Jerry, listen to this story. I used to tell people he told me he wanted a colonoscopy, and no one in my audience believed that anybody ever said those words. So he apparently said he needed a colonoscopy. So Larry tells me he needs a colonoscopy, calls the Wichita VA, says, I'd like to have it done here at home. I don't want to drive to Wichita to get a colonoscopy. And the person from the VA says, sir, I'm sorry, but you live within 40 miles of Hayes. There's a VA clinic in Hayes, and so you don't qualify for care in the community. Larry had done his homework and said, that shouldn't be a problem. I've already called the VA clinic in Hayes. They don't perform colonoscopies. The answer was, I'm sorry, sir, you live within 40 miles of Hayes. You don't qualify. So it's kind of things that you wouldn't expect that kept this program from working. We've done away with it still could be a distance issue, but the criteria now is whatever's in the best interest of the veteran. And who decides that is important, and who decides it is the veteran and his healthcare provider at the VA. So they're his doctor or her doctor or the mid-level. If they decide, the two of them decide it's in that veteran's best interest, then he or she can have care at home, or he or she could have care at where they believe they would get the best care. An example of that is a Bonner Springs Air Force veteran who had to have a kidney transplant, and the VA wanted to send him to some hospital he'd never heard of on the East Coast, and his point was, Senator, I think that the University of Kansas transplant program is something I trust, and I'd like to have it done there, because they do these all the time. He's now been able to have his kidney transplant at the University of Kansas. Incidentally, a bit of a distance issue too. Instead of going to the East Coast, he's going 20 miles to the east. So my point in spending this much time on this issue is one to express to all of you who served gratitude and respect and honor, but also if you or someone in your community that would want to have care done, it's not really outside the VA. The VA is still involved in your care, but if you want it done closer to home or with somebody of a level of expertise that you better trust, you now have that option. It probably will still take working to get it done, and that's why I'm here, and that's why our staff is here, and we're trying to use our position as chair of this Veterans Committee to take care of all veterans, but to particularly pay attention to those in Kansas who might need our help.
The Silver Hair Legislature are really concerned about the payroll tax furlough, and especially what that's going to do to Social Security on down the road, especially in light of the President's comment that his intent, January 1, to do away with it entirely. And while we say payroll taxes, to my understanding, that's our payment for Social Security and Medicare. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And where's the funding coming from if his intent is followed through to do away with that?
I and many of my colleagues, including Republican colleagues, oppose the idea of eliminating or reducing payroll taxes or to permanently rid ourselves. Social Security and Medicare, our trust funds, are in jeopardy. They in a few years, there'll be more. This is in many ways a demographic issue. There are more people who are retired and less people who are working. And the ability to keep Social Security and Medicare available for people as they retire and for our retirees is in large part determined by that payroll tax, that what we send in and what our employer sends in to build up those funds. And so for us to make a temporary benefit, I suppose, if you could call it that, for a long-term detriment isn't worth the cost in my mind. And I don't know that the administration can do this in the absence of congressional legislation allowing it to happen. But if we get in that battle, what that means is the courts will take years to determine the answer to that question. But I'm of the view that this is a congressional decision, and if given the opportunity, it's nothing that would pass the United States Senate.
Can you do anything to stop that other than, like you said, have to go for it?
What we have done is communicate this view to the president and to the administration. So I don't know, again, if I don't know what more to do other than to lobby the administration on this is not an idea that even most Republicans, at least in the Senate, support.
Okay.
If you have suggestions, I'd be glad to know. I'll be back in a year or so. I don't know that I know you well enough to have this banter, and I'll be laying in bed tonight thinking about the day, and I'll think, oh my gosh, what I said. I offended the farmer over here, indicating he didn't go to work. I told you I'd be back in a year to hear you again. I don't mean it seriously. All right. Good. I hope you'll be receiving your Social Security and Medicare benefits. Yes, sir. Hello again.
Do you think that the size of that national debt will have a bearing on the Fed, keeping those rates low, to hold down the interest on that debt?
How could it? The question was, does the increasing debt have a consequence at the Fed on interest rates? And my answer to that, I mean, you're the professional in this arena. But my answer to that is, how could it not? At some point in time, those who lend us money, despite all the Fed's efforts, when it begins to appear, or begins to more appear, that we can't pay it back, then interest rates rise. As the risks go up, they're going to demand more return when they loan us money, and rates will rise. And at some point in time, maybe they decide they're not even going to loan us money. And if we are lucky, fortunate is maybe a better word, if we're fortunate that the moment interest rates are as low as they are, if with this debt interest rates were where they are more historically, more traditionally, we couldn't afford the debt service if interest was 5, 6, 7% on government borrowing money. Already the debt, the service on the debt eats up, it's the third largest component of spending, is trying to pay for what the money we've already spent the interest on. So debt service is a huge component of our ability to get government back within the four corners of where it belongs. Yes, ma'am.
I'm in the accounting and tax business, and you addressed the PPP, and two things that I'd like to see you take a step further. One, they've simplified the PPP forgiveness, but I know that it had been in discussion to actually forgive it if it was under $150,000. When I looked at the statistics of the number of people who received PPP, most of them had 9 employees or less. Even the simplified form where you're calculating, did anybody get less than 75% of, oh, which period am I looking at? It still requires them to go seek outside counsel to figure that out. And because they're small, they're going to be looking, you know, beyond their own scope. So that is one thing I would love to see revived and acted on. And the second thing is that it's my understanding when the PPP was originally put in place, within Congress, that the concept was that not only was it forgivable, but the expenses for those items that were covered by PPP would be tax deductible. And then the IRS, holy cow, that's going to be like a double tax benefit. We can't do that. And so they put in a notice that said, no, 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 we're not going to count it as income, but you don't get the deduction, which means that the net bottom line for businesses is going to be as if it was income, and that does not provide the level of benefit that I believe was intended, and I think it's going to take a congressional act in order to undo what the IRS did on that.
The congressional acts are in the works, and I agree with both of your issues. The more, the easier to accomplish, if anything is easy in Washington, D.C., it's easier to accomplish the forgiveness, or the quote, automatic forgiveness. What I'm told that automatic forgiveness would be is that the borrower signing a one-page form affirming that they used the money as intended and agreeing to keep their records for 3 years. And if they do that, that's the form that allows that loan to be forgiven. I'm a sponsor of a bill to do exactly that. That bill, we're at loggerheads. I didn't say this earlier, but there is no consensus on what. I said it was more difficult. We passed things unanimously before. Now the politics has kicked in, the election. I don't know whether there's, you know, parties who don't want anything to be accomplished so that you can go into the election having failed. Whatever the motivation is, or reasons, we're not very close to having an agreement. But and as a result, the Republican senators are trying to put together a version of the bill, knowing that we would then need to negotiate with Democrats in the Senate, because there are 53 Republicans and it takes 60 votes to pass anything. In our version of the bill, I think it's not finalized, but I think I can say with pretty darn near certainty that it will include that loan forgiveness provision. The people who borrowed money, the businesses who borrowed money under PPP could go to their banks and can go to their banks today and say, I want to get this forgiven. And they're eligible to do it. And the process by which they do it is there. But most of our lenders are waiting till they find out whether the $150,000 threshold, which is what is in the Republican proposal, is enacted. So you don't go through all the paperwork to get it forgiven. We'll wait and see if there's an easier way to do it. And so we've created a lot of uncertainty while we wait for Congress to get this issue resolved. But that one, I think, will be resolved. I'm also a sponsor of the bill to make certain that we don't lose our deductibility of the expenses that the PPP loan paid for. And I'm less certain about how that one ends up. I would tell hospital folks, I don't know why I look at you, Susan, I would tell hospital folks, critical access hospital folks, this kind of concept is bothering me because I was in McPherson Hospital this morning, I was at Advent in Shawnee Mission earlier in the week, and last week I was in Colby because I've been kind of touching base with what's going on in healthcare and what's happened and what needs to happen. And one of the complaints is that on our cost report as a critical access hospital, if we had a PPP loan and those costs were forgiven, they don't count on the cost report, so we don't get reimbursed. It's the same thing, which would mean you get very little benefit from a program we intended to provide a pretty significant benefit. And perhaps there are people, taxpayers and others, who would complain that we're forgiving these loans. Our goal was to get something that kept people employed. This really wasn't a business, I don't think, a business benefit. It was keeping people employed. And I think it worked pretty well, despite the problems that you and bankers had in accessing the SBA in the early days, and the problems we had with the SBA not knowing how to handle sole proprietors, independent contractors, and farmers. So I'm all in for both of those, and we're trying to get them both accomplished, and I think there's a likelihood of at least one of those. Oh, and let me thank you and the bankers. Man, what a challenge it was, and it took a long time to get the SBA in a position in which they could make this a little bit easier. We certainly developed a close working relationship with the SBA and the Treasury Department during that period of time. I will tell you that the SBA is accustomed to. So the SBA makes $30 billion in loans a year, traditionally on normal days. This was $350 billion to be done in 2 weeks. And so, I mean, there were problems. I'm not discounting that. But we knew there'd be problems, and the goal was to get it done quickly. And I was calling businesses across Kansas before we passed this bill, outlining what this would be. And I had a number of people say, thank you for this call. I'm sitting here trying to figure out which employees I'm going to keep and which ones I'm not. And knowing this is coming, if you tell me this is coming, I'm not going to lay anybody off. And I think that was a pretty good, I mean, it was a good circumstance, and I think it was pretty widespread among businesses who were trying to keep their act together. The state received $1.25 billion, deducting about $100 million that went to Sedgwick County and $100 million that went to Johnson County because they met a population threshold. So there was about, whatever that is, hard to say, $1.25 billion less $200 million available to Kansas, and how they spent it. It had to be spent on paying for things related to COVID. My view, without trying to get governor or legislators in trouble, I don't think there's enough reason to spend that amount of money. That's more money than what we were spending or needed to spend on taking care of the expenses of COVID. So I'm working with colleagues who want to allow longer period of time for the money to be obligated and the flexibility to use it in more ways than what was originally intended. Otherwise, we're going to have, in my view, because I don't think government's going to send us a check back. So I would guess that we'd be smarter to create opportunities in which it could be spent wisely as compared to be spent just trying to beat a deadline to say, if we don't spend this money, we're going to lose it. So we're in the works of trying, in this next phase, of trying to add more flexibility and a greater length of time to pay it back.